Paul Ferguson is a busy writer. We'll hear about his work today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Some readers compare Paul Ferguson to H.P. Lovecraft. We'll ask him about that, among other things. Then we'll ask Garrison Keillor for the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Greetings, Paul. Just a short time before we went on the air, you started into stuff about your writing, which I found overwhelming. Do you ever stop writing?
Yes, those are my dark moments. I saw a quote the other day. It was, writing is the only thing that I do that doesn't make me think I should be doing something else.
That's good.
And that's pretty much how I feel. Yeah.
And has that been a feeling for a long time?
A long time. I started writing poetry when I was in fourth grade. I wrote my first musical in sixth grade, first short stories in seventh grade, and on from there.
You just have never stopped.
No.
What is it? Tweet, this happens. You know, we talk to people who seem to be compulsive writers. My compulsion is not to write. I don't get it.
What's the best part of writing for you and the worst part?
The best part is creating something out of whole cloth that makes somebody gasp or laugh or swear or whatever it is. It gets a reaction out of someone. I mean, from as little as a Facebook post to a full novel, that feeling can be the same.
Mm-hmm. But you write all kinds of things.
I do.
How many books have you written?
I've written two full novels, several short story collections, a couple of books that I call mockuments, which are meant to look like historical books, but they're freshly written. I've written musicals, plays, working on a television show right now, music.
Boy, that's shifting from genre to genre. What is the H.P. Lovecraft that we hear about? How did you get tagged with that?
Well, H.P. Lovecraft, as you know, was a horror writer from the 20s and 30s who wrote what's called cosmic horror, the idea that we're small blips in the universe and there are these huge otherworldly creatures out there just waiting to devour us. And I've always, since junior high, I really started reading Poe and Lovecraft and really got a feel for that sort of fiction. So when I write, and mainly it's my short fiction and my novels, I tend to write historical fiction because I am a historian by training. And then I throw in supernatural elements that bring in more of the Poe or Lovecraft concept.
What is there about Lovecraft? I'm sure many people listening today have probably never even heard the word, and let alone read anything by Lovecraft. I did partly because my son Jonathan, well, Randy too, got really interested in Lovecraft, went through a period in which they were really almost devotees of Lovecraft, and everything they wrote sounded like Lovecraft. What is his mystique? He's one of those writers who, when you meet somebody else who's read Lovecraft, you're immediately part of a select club.
You're right. I think Lovecraft has certain elements that I think make him unique and draw people in. He uses words that even people in Lovecraft's own time hadn't used in 200 years and puts them in fiction. He loves to describe the indescribable. He's famous for starting a paragraph by saying, it was a horror too terrible to be described, and then he spends two pages describing it. And his descriptions are laden with adjectives. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, that cosmic element, the idea that we have no control.
Now, you have done something with the writings of Lovecraft, haven't you?
I have. As an editor and a publisher through Necropolis Press, which is a local publishing house, I worked on a four-volume collection of H.P. Lovecraft works, so we presented his short stories in chronological order, starting with things he wrote as young as 13 and 14 years old, and presented them all in chronological order and footnoted them and wrote new introductions and study guide questions so they could be used as classroom work or as a book club.
Well, I was once that immersed in S.J. Perlman, but no longer. I mean,
right.
But that's a completely different field. You have written two novels, you say?
Yes.
What were titles and subjects?
My first novel was a book called A Life in Chiaroscuro, and it was set in Milwaukee in 1904. I chose that time and place because my dissertation for my PhD was on Milwaukee history, so I had a large collection of notes on that subject already. And once I finished my dissertation, I turned around and I started writing a novel based on some of that same research. And the main character is a newspaper editor who just comes to Milwaukee from Chicago to take on a job. He meets an artist who has uncanny artistic skills, and hijinks ensue. My second book was called Watershed, and again, that was based on research that I had done when I was in college at this point down in Macomb at Western Illinois. There's a place not far from Macomb called Vishnu Springs, which used to be a natural spring resort turn of the previous century. And I became fascinated by that place and did a lot of historical research based on it. And finally, I decided to write a series of books based on the rise and fall of Vishnu Springs, and Watershed is the first, which sets us up just before the establishment of the resort, and introduces the main character that I plan to carry through the series.
Are you working on the second one?
The second one is outlined. Everyone asks if I'm working on the second one, because especially if they've read the first one. But first, I'm finishing another novel, which is set in Cornwall. I hope to finish the draft of that by the end of this year, and then I can start the second Vishnu Springs book in spring, probably.
And that also includes an element of supernatural or horror fiction, would you call?
Yes. With Vishnu Springs, it's a little bit different because 90% of Vishnu Springs' history is in the book. And I would say 75% of it, what I said at the beginning of the first book in the series was that 75% of it is 80% true or something like that. with the Vishnu Springs series, almost every character is a real person who lived at the time. My main character is the main deviation from that. I invented him so he could see everything that happened. And then my interpretation of events is based on things I read in the newspapers from those time periods and people's journals and other things. So when I introduce, you know, the concept of ghosts or werewolves or something like that, those were in the newspaper. People were wondering. They were asking if those things were out there.
What's the appeal of horror fiction? It goes certainly way back to the Gothic in the middle of the 19th century in English fiction. When you write horror fiction, what are you expecting from your audience? What are you trying to do to the reader?
I'm trying to give them a jolt. And for me as a writer as
well.
Because
they need a jolt?
Sure. I think we all need a jolt. We need to get out of our ruts. I think the adrenaline is healthy. I also think it's healthy to question the indescribable and the unknowable in different ways. And horror fiction helps us do that.
It seems to me when you start studying something and you build up a pile of notes, you immediately turn around and write a novel about it.
Right.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I have several piles of notes waiting. I have literally a list 105 lines long of projects that I will do if – I don't die first.
I was going to say, how long do you plan to live?
Yeah, the most I've done in a year is 10 of those. So, you know, it's possible, but...
Even given a stack of notes, how long does it take you to put a novel together?
It depends on the book. The first book went, as it turns out, relatively quickly. I wrote my first novel on MySpace, of all things, back when there was a MySpace. And what I did was I was sick of talking about what I was going to do one day, and I decided to do it. So I went on MySpace and I told all my friends, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to put a chapter a week on MySpace and you can read it and tell me what you think and give me critiques. And I did that every week for something like 22 weeks. And at the end of that, I had a novel. And it took another year or so to get it edited and put together the way that it should have been. And even then, I didn't have the good editors that I have now that keep me in line. And then in, I think, 2007... it was a book that I could hold in my hand and everything, and then I just never stopped from that point.
You know, how important are editors to you, and what kind of authority do they have over your writing?
They have as much authority as I let them have as the writer, but I accept what they say almost 100%. If I disagree with the writer, it's only because they didn't see what I meant by something, as opposed to I disagree that that's wrong. Mm-hmm. When they tell me something's wrong, it's usually wrong, and I fix it. They're very good. They are not worried about hurting my feelings, which is useful. So I think editors are crucial, and I think editors are crucial for any writer. It doesn't matter how well you write or even as an editor. I'm an editor. I've been editing my stuff, other people's stuff. I publish other people's works. I'm a college professor, so I've gone through student papers for 15 years. You can't edit your own stuff. You just can't.
It's hard.
Because you see words where there are no words because you know they're supposed to be there.
Yeah, that is true. Those ghost words drive you crazy. But I must say it's amazing that you put all this together and you keep going like the Energizer Bunny. Now, how about poetry? You still into poetry?
Yes, I published my first poetry book in the spring of this year, actually. It's called 1,000 Miles or Less.
Can you read us a poem?
I can.
Yeah.
Last year, I started experimenting with a poetry style called the Spanish Romance Quarto, which is a very complicated setup, 6 syllables per line, a lot of alliteration, assonant rhyming. And so this was the first one, actually, that I wrote using that. And it's my war on flowers, basically, is how it comes across. Favored lovers falter, per presence then pretend. Pose poor ardor to air. Attend fail friends to mend. Whilst throngs sing sure sweet songs endearing dearest ears, one lone a drifting gift suggests at best fey fears. Whene'er you wend and woo tradition's tragic way, show some semblance of sense, eschew big bold bouquets. For fools who peddle petals to totem tempt the heart, bring but brief bought glory, wherefore fell florists art. Thrumming mums soon succumb, cue lust, crude cut, lost life. Each dead red riven rose, dried decor nigh thy knife. Stems stunned and stunted run to ruin, ruing truth. Flee, flowered bowing boughs, swoon too soon and yield youth. Near new hearth, oops, sorry.
Wrong page.
It's wrong page. Why should shorn blooms exhume such blush from faces fair? Can't scanty plants enchant when absent floral flare? Take the rake-racked tiller, stout steward to sown soil. Hard yards, good gardener hews, tempts trees through roiling toil. Borrowed fallow beauty, heed no such brutal breed. Besought not bulbous buds, sure sight sees only seeds. The plower powders plots with divine devotion, enduring permanence now his noble notion. Flowers fade, bowers brave, which would you chance to choose? Perfect perennials, or buds bred for abuse? Avoid vain voyeur's lure, prove love's long-lasting pro. Follow now no florist, go with the gardener. Grow.
Yeah, what is interesting about that?
That is a game.
Is that if you gave that to a person to read and said, "When was that written?" They would say, "Well, 18th century." It sounds like 18th century rap, which is a compliment.
Yeah, the Spanish Quarto is a I think it was a Renaissance adaptation, and so yeah, the style is very much old. And when I started writing in high school, I mean, what did I know about poetry? I knew Byron and Shelley and Keats. And so my early stuff, and it's in there, the stuff that I thought was worthwhile, I put in the book. This is really the first half of my poetic life, as I put it. There's a lot of Byronic poetry in there and romantics.
Well, what drew you to that style, though? That's tough.
When I write, sometimes I get in a rut and I don't know what to push forward next. And at those times, I like to find something I've never done and give it a whirl. And so I decided I wanted to write a new form of poetry, and I went out and I researched, and I found the Spanish Romance Quarto, and I thought, okay, I can try that. And I thought to work my way into the rhythm and into the rhyming scheme, and that's what I ended up with.
See, now there's a poet who believes in form.
Yes.
Yes. And that's
well, and it shows. I'm just astounded by what you just read.
Yeah, that's amazing. You write, you edit, you teach.
And now you have a television program.
I do, yes. Against the Odds is a web series that we've been working on for the past year, almost exactly a year. I'm working on it with my co-producer, Josh Kahn, who's a local comedian and MC. He's the host of Bottoms Up Burlesque. And he came to me with an idea for a television show. And I ended up being the lead writer. And so we worked together and put the thing together. And we're about finished with episode 4. Mm-hmm. And we have 3 more to shoot. And then we'll move on to our next television series, which is already planned and waiting in the wings.
Do you take time for dinner?
I eat standing up a lot. And I eat at my desk. And yes.
Actually, being busy and doing stuff you like can be a drug. I can remember days, you know, when I would just forget to eat because what I was doing was so engrossing. And it sounds as if you have that problem every day.
Yeah, food is not so much a problem. Sleep is certainly a problem. The question I get most is, when do you sleep? And, you know, 4 to 5 hours a night is probably what I average.
Oh, yeah.
And it's mainly because I don't want to. I don't want to go to sleep. There's things I could be doing.
You're talking to a guy who lived that for many years. Well, Paul, I must say, you are a very interesting person, and your work sounds like something all of us ought to explore. Give us the names of the novels again.
A Life in Chiaroscuro and Watershed.
And where might one get them?
All of my work is available at Amazon.
Okay.
So if you go to Amazon and type in Paul Thomas Ferguson, filter for books, you'll have dozens of things to choose from.
Excellent. Paul Ferguson's been our guest today, and next up is Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. And now to the book bag. And what do you have for us tonight, Dr. Tweet?
Well, the first thing I'm going to recommend is not a book at all, but a little magazine. There are still a few little magazines around that give you the best of contemporary writing. The market for short stories and a lot of poetry has pretty much dried up. But one of the enduring magazines, and I completely forgot about it till 2 weeks ago when Jeff Mason, one of the readers at APRIS, brought in a copy of an extra copy and gave it to me. It's Plowshares, put out before, I think, 41 years by Emerson College. It is one of the prestige little magazines. Every year it gives an award, and there are short story writers around the country that are just dying, first of all, to be nominated for a Plowshares Award and then to actually win one. It's very unusual. And the result is, in these 3 issues a year, plus a special themed issue, 4 issues a year, that you get the very best of contemporary short stories and poetry and essays.
Mm-hmm.
If you just want to keep current with the times and just have some good reading, it's $35 a year, which is not quite $10 an issue, but it is well worth it. And I don't know how I let my subscription several years ago lapse, but I went right out and re-upped it. You can get a hold of it on the internet. It's Plowshares by Emerson College. This summer, 2016, has international writers, including many of the writers that we've recommended from the Arabic world and the Mideast world and the African world. All I have to do, I think, is tell you that the advisory board for Plowshares includes Jane Hirschfield, Gerald Stern, Russell Banks, Carol Forche, Donald Hall, Robert Pinsky, Rita Dove, Joy Graham. I mean, you can't get a better cast of characters than that.
That's true.
So if you're at all interested in keeping up with reading, one of the great little magazines is Plowshares.
And while we're on that topic, let me throw in a vote for Arian magazine from Boston University. If you are interested in the classics, this little magazine comes out, I think, four times a year, and it is packed with absorbing material. If you have a taste for the classics, there's always a new translation of a Latin or Greek poem, sometimes several.
And sometimes original poems.
Yes, that's true.
I've discovered, since you gave me a subscription to that.
I did.
You did. Thank you so much.
Boy, and some days I just never know what I'm doing. Well, how about recommendations of books? Surely.
Well, let me give you another recommendation. The one I just finished is a very short book. It's another recommendation by Nan Carter, so of course it's Palestinian. It's by a writer, of apparently a famous long-standing writer, died in 1995, Jabra Ibrahim Jabra. And what I found interesting, it's called The First Well, A Bethlehem Boyhood. It's about his own account of growing up in Bethlehem from about 1926 to 1937 or 38, from when he was 5 to when he was 16 or 17. Growing up in a family that is working class, very poor, until he's almost 16, they cannot afford chairs for their house. Their rental house is three stories high. It's an old abandoned hotel. They live on the first leaky floor. The second floor is a old watchmaker, and the third floor is a Greek Orthodox church.
Hmm.
It is just, what I find fascinating, it's before all the conflicts between the Israelis, before there was an Israel, all the conflicts that are going on now between the Muslims and the Christians and the Jews. He grows right up. The apartment is not too far from the church and the nativity. His schooling, it's all private schooling. He gets in the pace to go to school. One of the first two languages he learns is Arabic and English.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing story.
What's the title again?
The First Well, A Bethlehem Boyhood.
Yeah, you have a surprising fund of these titles, and you're introducing us to something a literature that's foreign to most of us,
this,
I think.
This will be over at the WVIK Free Library for your perusal.
Very good. And the program will be over in just a few seconds. I want to thank you for tuning in. Roll Tweet and I, Don Wooten, will be back again next week. We invite you to join us for our very next Scribble.